That is all coming up on Flashpoints. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Our jails and prisons have become overcrowded with people suffering from mental illness. Many people incarcerated are also addicted to drugs and alcohol. What treatment is being provided? Tune in to Prison Pipeline April 14th to hear Doyle Smith of Dual Diagnosis Anonymous of Oregon talk about the need for treatment programs in our jails and prisons. That's Prison Pipeline April 14th at 6:30 p.m.
Brute force and the use of torture in the U.S. public school system. Also tracking white supremacists in the wake of the recent killings in Kansas City. And we'll feature our weekly broadcast from the Electronic Intifada, hosted by Nora Barris Friedman. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, we turn our attention to the recent shooting in Kansas City, which reflected really an ongoing battle against white supremacists, neo-Nazis, and you could call them Nazis. They would be proud to take that label on. They are in and out of the military, as this shooter was. And we want to focus on what happened in Kansas City and the broader picture in terms of what's happening in the context of white supremacists in this country. Joining us to talk about this is Devin Burkhart. He is the vice president of what is called the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. And, well, it's good to have you with us, Devin.
Thank you for having me.
All right. First of all, would you just remind people what exactly happened here? And one of the amazing details was that, in fact, it wasn't the guy didn't even he was apparently going after Jews, but he didn't hit any Jews.
That's right. On Sunday afternoon, the alleged perpetrator, Frazier Glenn Miller, showed up at a Jewish community center, shot and killed a grandfather and his grandson at the Jewish community center, and then went nearby to a Jewish senior center and shot and killed a Catholic woman in the course of his rampage.
And what do we know in terms of this specific incident? Was he planning this? Did he talk about this situation? Or was this just sort of a last-minute decision in terms of where he was going to go to open up fire?
From the information that we have thus far, it appears as though that this was a last-minute decision to decide to exact his revenge against his sworn enemies. We don't exactly know why he decided to lash out like this, but what we do know is that he has a long track record of promoting this kind of violent activities. In his memoir, for instance, he writes that one of his life's biggest regrets was that in 1987, when he and a group of his racist comrades were minutes away from engaging in a mass shooting in North Carolina, they backed out of that. And he's written that that's one of his life's biggest regrets. So in his later years, apparently he decided to make up for that regret by committing this horrific act in Kansas City.
Do we not know what kind of weapons he used?
We know that he had with him a rifle, shotgun, and other weapons. We don't exactly know the full extent of his arsenal, but he was using those when he started out.
All right. And let's talk a little bit about his background and how somebody with his background would be able to have access to this kind of weaponry. Tell us about a little bit more about what we know about him, and when's the last time you heard about him before this incident?
You know, at IREHR, we're very familiar with Fraser Glenn Miller. You know, he is a rabid Hitlerite who's spent more than four decades moving through the various corners of the white nationalist netherworld, bouncing from the margins towards the mainstream and back again. Glenn Miller first popped up on our radar screen back in the 1980s when he was the head of an organization in North Carolina called the White Patriot Party. This was a violent white supremacist proto-militia group which had thousands of members that engaged in paramilitary training as well as terrorizing local community members throughout North Carolina. It was one of the most frightening manifestations of this type of stuff during the period. In the course of doing that, Mr. Miller got involved with a group called The Order. The Order is a group that robbed an armored car for nearly $4 million, killed a Jewish talk show host in Denver, and a Missouri state trooper. Miller received around $200,000 in stolen money from The Order and went underground during that period. It was during that period where, as we talked about a few moments ago, he and a group of his friends nearly shot up a small town in rural North Carolina, and then he was eventually arrested for weapons charges and for sending out threats that included this declaration of war against ZOG, or the Zionist Occupation Government, as he referred to it. You know, he was eventually arrested in Missouri, where Missouri State Troopers had to use tear gas to extricate him from a mobile home where they found weapons and hand grenades and the other paraphernalia where he was preparing to carry out his sick version of a race war.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are speaking with Devin Burkhardt. He is the vice president of the group known as Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights. We're talking about how a white supremacist with a record like this, with such a violent. By the way, does he have a military background too?
He did. He served time in Vietnam. You know, and that was part of what gave him the impetus for the White Patriot Party's regalia. You know, instead of wearing the Klan robes like he did when he was a member of the Carolina Knights, he had members of the White Patriot Party dress in camouflage and fly the Confederate flag, as opposed to, you know, donning the pointy white hats and sheets. It was kind of a change at the time for the movement, and it also made him a very dangerous figure at the period, you know, someone we were very concerned about.
All right. You know, in terms of hate crimes, since 9/11, the Arab community, I mean, and you can be a Sikh too, and you have faced off with a sort of another war at home. I'm wondering if these white supremacist groups, do they take off on the sort of the anti-Arab atmospheric pressure that exists, that comes out of law enforcement, that we've seen through the extensive use of profiling? Are they triggered? Are they supported by sort of government actions that lead us in the direction of suppression and mistrust of the other, if you will, of brown folks, of all the other folks who have faced this kind of aggression after the 9/11 incident?
Yeah, well, what we've seen over the past decade or so is that white nationalists have become equal opportunity haters in terms of their aggression and the violent activities towards Latinos, towards Jews, and towards blacks, towards gays and lesbians, towards Arab and Muslim folks. They have spread their targets across the board, and what we've noticed is we continue to have incidents like this occurring year after year, and yet far too often these type of incidents are reported as isolated incidents or as kind of lone individuals, when we know that in fact there is a larger movement helping promote these ideas and recirculate them through society, and that the problems continue unabated. And that, I think, is a cause for concern, certainly for us at IREHR.org, but certainly for other organizations as well.
Now, I noticed that this is being dealt with as a hate crime. And, of course, that brings in the federal government and that intensifies all the potential punishments if a conviction comes down. But it's fairly unusual to get law enforcement to take it on as a hate crime.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, it becomes a challenge for jurisdictions to take it on as a hate crime. In this case, what it does is it provides some added insurance if, for whatever reason, a state jury wasn't able to find him guilty of murder. It provides federal jurisdiction to come in and prosecute him if a murder verdict isn't reached by a jury there in Kansas.
Well, let me ask you this before I let you go, Devin Burkhardt. Are there other folks you're worried about these days?
Absolutely.
Why don't you give us an idea of some of the folks who move in these circles who you may be concerned about?
You know, there are many individuals like that who we're always monitoring and keeping a close eye on. You know, just to give you an example, you know, in the case of Fraser Glenn Miller there in Kansas at the same Jewish community center back in August, the IREHR president, Leonard Zeskin, gave a talk which singled out Mr. Miller as a potential threat. He also met law enforcement this year and singled out Miller as a potential threat. In that particular region, there are members of a number of violent-prone neo-Nazi organizations, groups like the National Socialist Movement and the Aryan Nations, some who gathered in Kansas City just last November to hold a rally in downtown KC, who are continuing to be active, continuing to recruit new members, and continuing to find new ways to promulgate their violence on American society.
Well, I guess the point I was trying to make, I've heard many times over that when it comes down to the federal government and these kinds of investigations, sometimes it's the white supremacists who get the benefit of the doubt over Arab Americans, if you will.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's incumbent upon us to not rely on the federal government to take this issue on, but instead it's upon all of us to ensure that people don't get involved in white nationalist activity in the first place. I think that requires not a law enforcement response, but a community response where everyone comes together and says that we're going to build a barrier against bigotry here and not allow more people to get sucked into this downward spiral of hatred and bigotry.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. But if people want to get more information about the work that you do over there at the Institute, what's the best way to do that?
I would encourage everyone to go to our website at irehr.org and sign up and get involved and plug into ways in which they can help fight hate in their local communities.
And they'll be able to also get more information about the work that you're doing and sort of background on other folks that may be being tracked?
Absolutely, yes.
All right. Thank you for being with us on Flashpoints today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. I'm Dennis Perenstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we're delighted again to be joined by Mark Carlin. He's the editor of Buzz Flash at Truth Out, a wonderful news service, daily news service. I recommend it highly. And Mark, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you so much for having me, Dennis.
Weather calming down there in the Windy City in Chicago off the lake?
I think, as I mentioned before, because of climate change, it's like a rubber band. It snaps back and forth. So here in April, yesterday, Chicago was covered with snow, which I never recall in all the time I've lived in Chicago.
Well, okay, that's good to know. Let's talk a little bit about this piece you put up on BuzzFlash, Just Say No to Tasering Students and Militarizing Our Schools. And interestingly enough, here, the New York Times does take a stand. I mean, I'm a former New York City school teacher, and I've seen a lot of violence inside the schools and haven't ever heard much from the big newspaper in New York about this. But why don't you set up the scene? What is the Times saying? What are you saying?
Well, just as a little background, what's most interesting is during this period post 9/11, when the United States was engaged in torture, probably still is, the New York Times would never call this torture. They called it enhanced interrogation. They wouldn't use the T word, so to speak. And so here an editorial pops up last week that's somewhat astonishing, because this is by the editorial board. It's not an op-ed. It's by the New York Times editorial board. And they write an editorial that it's time to stop torturing our children in school. And so they would never use the T word for what was done physically to brutalize, to kill people at Abu Ghraib and so forth. But they use that word, and I'm sure they didn't choose it lightly, that there was a lot of discussion about that. But the editorial's headline, Torturing Children at School. And then it goes on to talk specifically about the use of the taser by so-called security personnel stationed in most urban schools. Actually, they're in most suburban schools now, but the amount of militarization, including weaponry, guns, tasers, and so forth, increases as you get into urban areas,